Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at a Wisconsin murder that happened in 1970 with our first guest today. She is Dorothy Marsick, an adjunct professor at Columbia University, playwright, former professor at Vanderbilt University's Owen Graduate School of Management. And she's authored 15 books. Her latest is titled With One Shot, Family Murder and a Search for Justice. In it, she documents the search for answers in the shooting death of her uncle, a former police detective. So we'll learn about what she found, why she believes the truth may not have been uncovered at that time, and certainly take your questions and comments as we move along. Do you remember? Are you old enough to remember the case? What questions do you have about investigating a cold case? Do you think the wife was really guilty? Join the conversation. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can tweet us at L. Mueller Show. Dorothy Marsick, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for taking time.
Thank you, Larry. It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, you know, I was pretty young when that happened, but I have a vague remembrance of it. And, of course, it got that remembrance got a lot sharper as I read your book. But tell us the basic facts about the murder, the victim, when and where it took place, who was charged.
Well, my uncle, Laverne Stordock, had spent most of his life in Beloit, Wisconsin. He was a police officer. He was promoted to chief of captains, very well respected. He was married to a woman that we might say was June Cleaver, and they had a daughter. They had what seemed to me like this perfect family life. Then he had a torrid affair with a woman named Suzanne, was on her third husband, and they both got divorced. They got married, and 7 years later, half my uncle's head was blown off on the bedroom walls, and she confessed. Her fingerprints were on the gun, but so were her son's from marriage number two, who was my uncle's stepson. So they had fingerprints from both of them. They took him to police station. They were going to arrest David, but Suzanne said, "No, I'll confess if I can have an insanity plea," which she got. And 11 months later, after being in a mental hospital, no prison time, she got out completely cured of chronic paranoid schizophrenia, which psychiatrists tell me you can't be cured of. And she got all my uncle's assets, including his life insurance, and she even got double indemnity. But there was always questions hanging in my head. Did she really pull the trigger? Was it her? Was it David? Because there was a lot of ambiguity around the case. And so it hung over us, and it was 4 years ago. My cousin Shannon from the first marriage and I started doing our research, and it ended up with this book called With One Shot.
That was an absolutely amazing story. You know what was amazing to me was, at the time, she winds up with only 11 months in a facility, and then she gets to collect the insurance.
You know, this is like so unbelievable. My cousin Shannon at the time sued the insurance company and said, by virtue of the fact that she has confessed to murdering my father, she should not get the money. And Shannon lost. And we didn't know until I was going through this research, and about 3 years ago when I was going through all the probate documents, that, which are mind-numbing, by the way. There was 93 pages, and some of them were blurred, and maybe the seventh time through, I looked, and I said, does that say double indemnity? And sure enough, we had never known this all these years, that she actually got double indemnity on the insurance after confessing to murdering my uncle.
It's just absolutely amazing. Dave in Augusta has something for us that surely relates here. Dave, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good morning, Larry. Hi, Dorothy. You probably recognize my voice. I want to thank you for writing the book and help clearing up some of the mystery that has surrounded this case and especially affected the people in the neighborhood where I grew up, which is only two houses away from the Stordock house. I just finished the book a few days ago, for the second time, and it is absolutely wonderful. So thank you again, Dorothy.
Well, thank you, David. And I was in Oregon last week doing a book reading. Oregon's a small town. 100 people showed up because it was their town that this brutal murder happened. And I really appreciate your comments, David. It affirms what I did, and it was for my family, and it was to search for the truth.
Yeah.
You bet. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dave, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, with your questions or comments. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. So, Laverne Stardock, or Vernie, or Vern as you call him in the book, talk a little more about your relationship, what he was like and your relationship with him.
Everybody said this when I was in Oregon, and I also did a book reading in Beloit where he'd spent a lot of his life. They all said he was a great guy. He was funny. He was there all the time. I mean, that was my memory, but you sort of wonder, well, are people just saying this to me because, you know, I'm his niece? But if you go back in the police reports, they interviewed all the neighbors and friends after the murder, and they all said the same thing, this great guy. He was full of life and energy, and Suzanne, well, you know, she didn't interact with people much, and she was a little strange, especially when she drank. So it wasn't just because they were telling me. They told the police the same thing. I was very close to him. I was a young college student when the murder happened, and my uncle had picked me up on many weekends in Madison and drove me to Oregon to spend time with him and his new family. So I got to know them pretty well, more than I think anybody else in my family. And he was always there for me. And I remember I tracked down one of his best friends, Joe Rosnos, who died last year, but I managed to talk to him about a year before that. And he said, I think about Vernie every day. He was the most wonderful person. And his daughter, who he lived with at the time, said, every time I think of Vern, I think of fun.
Mm.
So, when you get to a certain age, you had a number of people in your family die. I'm not the only one. But I've had people die through cancer or insulin shock and, you know, even a suicide. But there's something different about a murder, especially somebody who's in the prime of their life. It's so much more difficult to make sense of, to deal with, to move on from.
And it took you a long time to write this or to start this investigation. How did you finally decide to do that after so many years had passed?
That's such a good question, Larry. My cousin Shannon, who was from the first marriage, she and I had been talking for probably 10 years. Whatever happened to Suzanne and her family? We started to do a little digging, but we didn't realize that some of them had changed their names and they'd moved far away. David did not change his name, but there's a lot of David Briggs in the U.S., so where do you start? I mean, Suzanne had changed her name, her daughter had changed her name, and the youngest son had killed himself, Suzanne, that was from her third marriage. But then the Internet started getting more information, and my cousin Shannon was really focused on the Find a Grave site, and she found the grave of the youngest, Suzanne's youngest son, Danny, and she was able to find what names they had all changed into from that and track them down. And she called me in February 2014, said, Dorothy, I found them. And I knew exactly what she meant. She gave me their phone number. She said, call them. We have to know what happened that night. In the beginning, that's all we wanted to know. Who shot my uncle? And I said, no, I was in rural Tennessee, and I was just moving from Nashville up to New York. I said, I'll go there. I'll drive. You know, it was a five-hour drive. She said, no, you can't. It's dangerous. And I said, well, they haven't done anything in, 40 years? And she said, well, not that we know of, which actually turned out to perhaps be true. And she said, don't forget, one of them murdered my father. Yeah. But here I am. I've always been sort of a fool's rush in where angels fear to tread kind of person. I go, no, I'm going to go there. I'm going to go, and I'm going to ask them. I'm driving through these really darkened, abandoned roads with a lot of mobile homes with yellow streaks down the side and 20 rusted cars piled on top of each other and getting lost. And I thought, oh, my God, I could just disappear here and nobody wouldn't know what happened to me. And then I turned the corner, and there was this white, lovely house with a barn in the back. And I found them, and I had this sort of, you know, naive idea I could just walk in and after 20 minutes go, well, so one of, which one of you did murder my uncle? Which, as you can imagine, is not how it turned out. And nobody wanted to talk about it except David wanted to talk about it a little bit. And so I left that night. They offered, you said, why don't you stay overnight? And I'm going, oh, I'm thinking, the only thing I knew at the time was that my uncle was murdered in his bed. I thought, no, I'm not staying here, sorry. So somebody in this house killed my uncle when he was in bed, so no thanks. But I just said, oh, I have to leave. And they were very polite, very nice to me. I started talking. David would call me every week. We started Skyping, and ended up going back another three times to get more information. It wasn't probably for about 6 months that I decided to write a book. In the beginning, Shannon and I just wanted to know who murdered Laverne Stordock. But as I was not able to find that answer from them, I started getting the court documents and the police records and interviewing people. And then suddenly it was, wow, this is a really great story. And that's when I decided to do the book.
Oh. Joan in Green Bay has something for us. Let's go to her. Hi, Joan.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I just wanted to say to Dorothy that I also wrote a book. It was just published last year about the Green Bay Tom Monfils case.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much misinformation, and I've been listening to how she talks about how the details get muddled and people don't really know the facts and how things are just left to what's maybe reported in the news. But I wanted to share my appreciation for what she's doing, creating awareness about this and setting the record straight, because that's what I'm trying to do as well.
Yeah,
I appreciate that, Joan, and you're so right about the misinformation. I mean, one of my motivations was the fact that on the front page of the Wisconsin Dade Journal, it said my uncle had abused Suzanne, and that's she had a psychotic break and killed him. There was no evidence of him abusing anybody ever. I even asked her own children, did you ever see my uncle abuse your mother? No, we never did. We saw her abuse him. But that one newspaper article, everybody believed that. And so that was part, if this is true, I want to know. If it's true, I want to know
right.
who abused it. But if it's not, I want to set the record straight. And I found that the court documents, the transcripts in the court documents, had almost no relationship to the police forensic files. And you think, wow, when I first started seeing all this, I thought, is this Wisconsin in the 1970s or is it Alabama in the 1930s? You know, it was, I almost went through an identity crisis. I'm from Wisconsin. This doesn't happen there, you know?
Oh,
well,
man.
What's really tragic with the Monfils case is the mother has since died. Her son, she died believing that her son was murdered.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Joan, I thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. We're talking today with Dorothy Marsick, adjunct professor at Columbia University. And her latest book is titled With One Shot, Family Murder and a Search for Justice. Laverne Stordock, who was murdered, his wife was convicted of murdering him, or at least she said that she killed him, Suzanne Stordock. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 11:45, we'll be talking with Dr. Stephen Masley about how to sharpen your brain and prevent memory loss. That's next on the Ideas Net. Right now, visiting with Dorothy Marsick, adjunct professor at Columbia University, about her book, With One Shot, Family Murder and a Search for Justice. And again, join in, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'd love to hear from you. You know, it must have been kind of strange to be able to actually talk with the with Suzanne, the person who admitted to or confessed to killing your uncle. What was it like?
Well, it was kind of strange because she was old, like she was in her 80s, and she was very pleasant, but she didn't want to talk about the murder. In that house, you could never use the word murder or kill. They would say when it happened. And I realized, because when I called them on the phone, they didn't remember me. And it was sort of, well, Shannon and I have been talking about you for all these years. They had photoshopped us out of their lives. And why not? Because
sure.
Why do they want to have to remember? I mean, we can't forget that my uncle was murdered. But they were all very pleasant to me, and Suzanne was pleasant. And, once in a while she'd say something and then I could see her brain going, oh, my gosh, I think I said too much, and how do I backtrack? But David, the son, was the only one that was willing to be open with me, and he became more and more open over time. And then he emailed me in December one year, and he said, I have to talk to you. So we made an appointment on that Sunday night, and I was leaving the next day for Germany for a conference. And he said, okay, I have to talk to you about Vern and Gott. And I said, well, I'm really tired, and it's been a long day. Let's just talk about Vern, okay? And he was starting to confess to me and talking about the fingerprints and blood splatters and all this, and he got very agitated. Oh, Dorothy, you don't realize how traumatic it was for me and my mother that night. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, I guess it was traumatic for my uncle too. But I didn't want to press him any further because he was obviously going through something. And I thought, well, when I get back from Germany in a few days, we'll continue the conversation. And then 4 days later, I got an email from his sister saying he had dropped dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
I discovered some other unusual, mysterious deaths during my research as well. But talking to Suzanne, I ended up talking to her brother also. I got a lot more information from him. But it was, I'm sitting talking to her and I'm thinking, did you murder my uncle or not? But then I had to forget that because I had to just, make conversation and talk to her and so on. But it was strange.
She Suzanne led to quite a life of several marriages, as you said, but she also went on to get advanced degrees and I think a law degree, too.
Yes, she did. When she was married my uncle, she was, on her third divorce, and she'd only had a semester in college, and her brother told me that she'd amassed a lot of money from her three husbands, even before my uncle, and then she got a lot of money from my uncle and his insurance and properties and so on. So she never really worked full-time after that. I mean, she had but she went to school. She got her bachelor's degree. Then she got a master's and in sociology, all about women in prison. And then she got a doctorate in sociology, and then she got a law degree. And she had some kind of a law practice. I tried to do some research on it, but the phone number and the address were the same as her apartment, so I don't think it was really big, because she also ran for state legislature, and she was an insurance agent, and, she did several other things. So she did a lot. She was very smart. She was asked to join Mensa, as she liked to tell me, and she was very, very intelligent, and she did do a lot of schooling.
At one point, you say you were beginning to believe Suzanne was really a nice person, but that changed. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, the fourth time I was there, and I think by the third time, I knew that I was going to write a book, and they knew, and Suzanne was just so... She was much more open on the third visit than she'd been on any other one. So I thought, well, this is great. I mean, I don't know what it was, if being in a book or, the attention or just the mood. So then by the fourth visit, I had texted the daughter ahead of time to say, well, your mother's going to be a major character in the book. And the daughter texted me back, well, we have a lot to talk about when you get here. And then when I got there, she said, well, my mother isn't really keen on this, and she wants me to write her book, meaning the daughter. And but the daughter said, I think artists, you know, each artist can draw the same mountain, but it's going to look different, so I don't have any problem with it. But then towards the end of the visit, and at each break, and at this meeting, Suzanne was very tight-lipped. She didn't want to talk much, and she kept, you know, sending me out of the room. And then when I was ready to leave, her daughter came in and said, so have you two worked it out about the book? And I said, well, I mean, I'm writing a book. You're going to write a book. And then Suzanne got so angry, and I saw this rage in her eyes that was terrifying. And she said, only my daughter can write the book. She's the only one. She has. She's my daughter. I paid all this money to send her to college, and she's very smart. And I said, yeah, she's very smart, and she's very talented. I'd seen some of her writing. And she just, I mean, she wouldn't have been, you know, 86 years old. I don't know what she would have done. But I left. I ran out of the house, and I got in my rental car, went to the airport, and it was a time when American was just merging their ticketing system with U.S. Air, and I got to the airport, and they couldn't find my ticket. And I was, like, ready to fall on the floor, beg them to get me out of this city. I just have to leave the city. And finally, these two tech guys came over, and within 20 minutes, they found my reservation and my...
got out of there.
Yeah, it's like, I'd take me anywhere. Take me to Charlotte. I don't care. Just get me out of it. It was scary, yeah.
Steve in Green Bay, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
I just thought I'd let you know that I'm the chairman of a cold case review team here in Wisconsin. We work under the auspices of the Wisconsin Association of Homicide Investigators.
Mm-hmm.
There's 12 people on our team, both retired and current investigators. Some of them have been awarded Homicide Investigator of the Year. And we've reviewed a number of cases, and there's been progress in many of them.
It's so important. Your work is really important.
Well, talk a little bit about the, you know, as long as Steve's on here, too, talk about your review of the facts of the case and how they were different from...
Well, yeah, the court case was, I mean, her final hearing, for example, was about 12 minutes long. My grandmother and my aunt went there, and they sat there, and then everybody got up, and they go, what happened? And one of the reasons the district attorney said we have to grant this insanity plea to her is because when she was brought to the police station and arrested on Sunday afternoon, her physician showed up at the request of her attorney, and it was just a GP. He said, oh, she needs to go to the mental hospital. He called up Dr. Lee Roberts in the University Hospital, said, yes, we'll admit her, and we can do a psychological evaluation. So they took her Sunday night to the hospital, and then they had to bring her back for the arraignment on Monday morning. And then they took her back to the hospital. So the assistant DA said, we have to grant this insanity plea because the state allowed her to go to the hospital before she was arraigned.
Hmm.
Yeah, you're like, I read this like 8 times. I'm going, what? This doesn't make any sense at all. And one of the, I hired 2 forensic experts to help me, and one of them looked through all the court documents. She said, I'm surprised no professor has taken this case on, because she said, I've never seen a case that had so many legal gymnastics. So that was just one thing. But then you look at the, you know, her story about having a psychotic breakdown and that she was a shooter did not match the forensic evidence at all. And I hired another forensic expert who worked with actual police forensic files to help me, because I thought, well, this is my uncle. I'm biased. I want some outside opinion to make sure that. And as I worked through the case, and the Dane County Sheriff's Department was so helpful to me. They were wonderful. They they even said, wow, we don't know how this case turned out that way, and they ended up agreeing with what my conclusions were. But it was a strange case because the sheriff who, right after the murder, the first thing Suzanne did is call Sheriff Jack Leslie in his home at 2 in the morning, and he got run out of office 2 years later on ethics violations. The psychiatrist, Dr. Lee Roberts, who gave her the insanity plea, he lost his medical license a few years later because he was having sex with patients. And the assistant district attorney, Victor Musala, was later disbarred. So, you know, there are all these, you know, characters that maybe their ethics wasn't on the highest level.
Hmm.
One of the things about cold cases is that the evidence and the files, some of them are so old that files deteriorate. Sometimes there's accidents in the evidence room, like a flood or a fire. Sometimes if the case is very high profile, people steal the evidence right out of the evidence room. So that, it's very difficult because the evidence can be so deteriorated.
Yeah, there was no physical evidence. The police apologized. I don't know if it disappeared or somebody stole it. I mean, Suzanne Starduck, which was her name at the time, that identity evaporated. I've gone back. I've got a subscription to these programs where you can go back and look at arrest records way back. And hers never shows up, and I've found arrest records of other people at that time in Wisconsin. And when I contacted the FBI to get my uncle's file, they said, yeah, we found it, and we're going to send you another email to tell you how much money you owe for copying. And then I didn't hear from them, and I contacted them back a few weeks later, and they go, oh, no, that file doesn't exist. You know, I don't know. You know, maybe they made a mistake the first time, but I kept finding things like this also that were very strange, which I'm sure you do too, Steve.
Yeah, it's interesting. I thought just the whole business of that she had never fired a gun or didn't know how to use a gun.
Oh, you know, exactly. I mean, by her own admission and by everybody else that I talked to and in the police reports, she had never picked up a gun. And the weapon that was used to kill my uncle was a Mauser 8mm converted army rifle, which is called a sniper's rifle because it's so accurate. I found one in the Oregon gun shop. I went there and I explained to this guy about the murder and what had happened. And this guy, Johnny, goes, ma'am, even if I gave you this gun and gave you the bullet, you wouldn't know what to do with it. So, and the Lieutenant Rausch at the police department told me that in times when if somebody has a psychotic breakdown, you have less ability to use your motor skills, so you're not suddenly become this great marksman. And I had this wonderful researcher, Gregory Smith, who helped me a lot finding. He got a copy of the police records. I had gotten the police records, but mine had a little more redaction than I wanted. And then about a year later, Greg Smith was able to get one that had less redaction, and I was able to solve a few mysteries from that more transparent police document. So that was great.
What in the records surprised you the most?
Well, here's what surprised me, that my uncle's sitting on the side of the bed, and he's looking at the corner, because they can tell exactly where the bullet went in and out and in the wall, and half of his brain went off to the right side, and the shooter was to the left, about 6 or 7 feet. When they took Suzanne and David to the police station, they took brain tissue out of Suzanne's hair.
Oh.
So that's sort of like, wait a minute, let's look at this a little further. So there were a number of things like that, that, you know, he had a, my uncle, his last job was as an investigator for the State Medical Examiner's Board. He had an attaché of drugs that he took around to these anti-drug meetings, but it was in his home, and it was open, and the police had the whole contents of it. It was like 30 kinds of drugs. Suzanne's mother said she'd been a drug addict. Oh, how, you know, where, from what? Who was, you know, so there's a lot of questions about that I didn't know, but things that were surprising.
Do you think they treated Suzanne with some leniency because they believed she was covering for David, or they were somehow protecting Vernie's reputation?
Well, both of those stories I heard from people. That's not my theory of what happened, because my uncle had told several people before, a couple weeks before this, that he was going to leave Suzanne and go back to his first wife, Janelle, in Beloit. And in fact, in the night of the murder, they were in a bar, and he was overheard by a couple people saying that he told Suzanne he was going to go see his daughter the next day, and she got very upset. And a couple, two or three hours later, he was dead. But, you know, one of the psychiatrist reports said that she had a neurotic attachment with her children, and that she used her, manipulated her children through, with family crises and suicide attempts. So, you know, I don't know. If David pulled the trigger, I don't think it was his idea. Let's put it that way.
Are you still investigating this case?
Yeah, well, I am still. I'm amazing. A lot of people have come forward who read the book and have given me a little bit more information. So, I mean, it's not huge things, but it's filling in the blanks, and it's very interesting. And I'm open to learn. So anybody out there, if you know anything, or if anybody knows what I've been trying to find, and Greg Smith's been trying to help me find TV footage, because my uncle, it was in 14 newspapers, his murder, and some of them carried it for 2 years, but we've been unable to find any TV footage, or maybe people have movies that they took on their own. If anybody knows how we can find that, that would be really wonderful.
What advice do you have for anyone who wants to do something like you did, reopen an investigation, that sort of thing?
That's a good question, Larry. I think, first of all, make sure you really want to do it, because it's going to soak up your whole life for years. And for me, it was very gratifying, but it was 24/7 for 2 years and then intense for another 2 years. And if you really want to do it, it's worth everything. Several people have told me one thing they like about my book with one shot is it lays out a template for somebody who wants to do this kind of investigation. What did I know? I was a college professor and a playwright. I didn't know about murder investigations, but I'm smart, and I know how to research, and I learned how to figure it out. And for somebody else who also needs to learn how to figure it out, you can follow the steps that I did in the book. And there's so many more public records available that I had any idea of. Some of them are difficult. They take a lot of energy to get, but it's well worth the effort if it's something that's really burning in your heart.
I was thinking about your uncle a little bit here. You know, he was the victim here, but there are other victims in this case, including you.
Mm-hmm. My grandmother, she was 77 when he was murdered, and her other two living children died 7 years after that. And I've written it up in the book, but I think it's some related to the stress and from the case, and she outlived them. It was a horrible burden for her. For my cousin Shannon, his only natural child, for his first wife, who didn't even date for 7 years because we all knew he was going to go back to her, and then she married not long after that. And for Suzanne's children, who were just swept up into this maelstrom that they had no, you know, it wasn't their fault, and they had to live this life somebody in that house was a murderer.
Have you been able to find any closure at all?
Yes. I don't think you can ever get 100% closure when somebody's murdered, but this has been when I said before, Shannon and I wanted to know who pulled the trigger. The desire to find out the truth is really strong, and I did find out, I think, 90% of the truth, and the desire for justice, even though there's no legal recourse at this point, the fact of setting the record straight really feels like justice to me and to my cousin and the rest of the people in my family who, you know, I have cousins, and I had some aunts that I interviewed that have died since I started working on the book because they were very old. But it was all, for all of us, it was answers that we were searching for over 40 years.
You are going to be, you've been on quite a book tour here. You've got one more book signing in Wisconsin for sure that I know about.
Yes.
Tomorrow at 7 o'clock in Madison at the bookstore Mystery to Me.
Yes, yes, I'm going to be interviewed by Doug Moe. And last week I did five presentations around the state in Wisconsin, and then I'm going on to Arkansas and some other places after that. But, yeah, the ones in Wisconsin were very meaningful for me. And in Madison, where I went to school and where my uncle worked, it's going to be emotional. I'm looking forward to seeing people at the Mystery to Me bookstore tomorrow night.
Yeah, tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. And I can tell you, Doug Moe is a really good interviewer. I'm an old friend of Doug's. And so it's sure to be a really interesting evening. Dorothy, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Pleasure talking with you. Interesting read of your book, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Larry, it was wonderful. Thank you. Great, you're a great interviewer.
Dorothy Marsick is an adjunct professor at Columbia University, a playwright. She's written 15 books. Her latest is titled With One Shot, Family, Murder, and a Search for Justice. And if you want to see her in person and see her interviewed by Doug Moe, you can go to tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, at the bookstore Mystery to Me in Madison. Well, coming up, we're going to switch gears and talk with you about ways to reverse cognitive decline with our next guest, Dr. Stephen Massley, next on the Ideas Network.